Right now, it's time for our monthly check-in on some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science with Discover Magazine's Gemma Tarlak. Last week, NASA announced the Mars rover had found organic material on the red planet, which could have some interesting implications for life in our galaxy. And Gemma shares a bunch of fun science facts, the things we need to know about clouds, ants, and mass extinction. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, good to be with you.
Let's start up on Mars, Gemma. What did the rover discover?
Well, unfortunately, we cannot answer David Bowie's question, tell me, is there life on Mars? But it did find two kind of cool new things. Now, other teams in the past have found suggestions of methane on the planet. So this new evidence of methane is not exactly earth-shattering, but the key thing about this new evidence that there's methane there is that the scientists were able to document it over about a 55-month period, that it was seasonal in nature. Basically, there's a big spike in methane during the northern hemisphere summer on Mars. And that helps give them more information and also more confirmation that there is actually methane there. But, you know, a lot of things produce methane. Here on Earth, living things, perhaps most famously cows, produce methane. And then, of course, when we all, shuffle off this mortal coil, the actual decomposition process produces methane. And there are also other non-biological methods. Certain volcanic eruptions, for example, produce methane. So just because they've found methane does not mean that there is something alive producing it. So I think it's important to have that caveat.
Now, methane is a little organic molecule, if I remember high school chemistry right. They also found some more complicated organic compounds, right?
Well, I think it's really important that the terminology here, because when I saw this story breaking, I saw a lot of people saying they found organic matter on Mars, and that's not quite right. What they found were organic molecules that appear to be pieces of larger and more complex molecules, the kind of thing you might find in coal or shale here on Earth. And again, the fact that they found them is very exciting, and it's an achievement for the scientists driving this research, but it's not the smoking gun, so right, to say, about life on Earth. So again, there are a lot of different ways it could have ended up there, and it's kind of a couple more baby steps towards resolving if there is life on Mars or if there ever was life on Mars. So very exciting development.
As I read it, Gemma, it's necessary but not sufficient. To have life as we know it, you need this kind of stuff, but finding this stuff doesn't say anything about whether life is there.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, yeah.
All right, now I want to move on. You all had some fun at Discover Magazine. You picked a bunch of different topics and gave us kind of a need to know, the stuff we need to know about this. And Gemma, people tackled clouds and personality and music. Let's start with yours. You went for mass extinction.
Of course, this tells us
something about Gemma, first of all. But what do we need to know about mass extinction, Gemma?
Well, I think there's a lot of interest in mass extinctions across the board. Not to be morbid, but just to imagine that there are forces out there that can just completely end life as we know it on the planet, and that this has already happened in the geological record at least five times. We've got these, in the last half billion years, we've got these five mass extinctions, these great die-offs. And when you sit and think about it from like a philosophical perspective, it's kind of shocking and also kind of fascinating. How does this happen? What exactly happens? But I want to stress that just because it's called a great die-off, it's not all bad news, because with every mass extinction, what we see is in the aftermath, you know, to quote Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, life finds a way, nature finds a way. And what we see is after all these horrible things happen and so many species die, we see this incredible boom in biodiversity as the planet recovers. And a lot of times, you know, one door closes, another door opens. And we see, for example, the end of dinosaurs 65.5 million years ago. That is actually directly responsible for the rise of mammals, including us, because it kind of cleared all those ecological niches so that other animals could step in and develop and radiate into many different species. So not all bad news.
And the previous extinction to that one, you write, had opened the door for the creatures that became dinosaurs and the earliest mammals.
Yeah, exactly. You know, at the end Triassic, for example, the Triassic mass extinction of about 201 million years ago, it kind of wiped clean a lot of the ecological niches, and dinosaurs, which had already begun to evolve, they hit their stride, and all of a sudden they were exploding in diversity, spreading across the Earth. So it was a great time to be a dinosaur.
And one worried, and on a serious note, concerns that there might be a sixth extinction, and it might be in large part our fault.
Yes, yeah, and there is kind of, quite frankly, a terrifying amount of information out there. And in 2015, for example, researchers using a number of different ways to model and estimate the rate of extinction, they found that the current pace of extinctions of species on the planet is up to 100 times what's called the background rate. Now, the background rate is, you know, life is not forever, and there's always one species is going extinct, another species is emerging, and it's this background kind of static rate that exists throughout history and prehistory, geological time as well, of course. But this background rate spikes, and when you see those spikes, that's a sign of a mass extinction. And they found evidence that we are in the middle of one of those spikes. And it's actually, what to me is the most sobering part, is that a lot of researchers feel that by looking just at species becoming extinct globally, we're kind of missing the true horror of what one team of researchers called biological annihilation. And I realize that's a very scary term, and we should all be a little bit scared because, you know, it's not just like a species wakes up one morning and goes extinct globally. That does not happen. It's a slow downward spiral. First, it starts with the destruction and fragmentation of habitat, the introduction of invasive species. And then, you know, over time, localized extinctions called extirpations take place. And the species becomes weaker and weaker in terms of how far it's spread. And that leads to global extinction over time. And what we're seeing now is the number of local extinctions or extirpations is even higher than the actual global extinction rate. So that's very sobering. And, yeah, we're to blame. It's all on us.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine. She's telling us some things we need to know about a variety of topics. Let's look up now, Gemma, at the clouds. We see them every day. I'll admit I take them for granted. What is a cloud? I mean, not in a poetic sense, like in a real science-y sense. What is it?
I think that I shall never see. Now, clouds, basically, they're just a bunch of water drops. They are teeny tiny water drops, whole piles of them, and we can't appreciate them with the naked eye just as a water drop. They're so small, but the atmosphere is full of these tiny water drops. And basically, as they rise, they cool off and they attract things. Things stick to them. Like, of course, pollution is one example, but also just, you know, dust, pollen, ice, sea salt, all kinds of stuff. Sand, for example, even. And so these vapors and the water droplets with stuff attached to them, just based on the temperature, the atmospheric height, what's stuck to them, all these different factors control how they're shaped and how they behave. And there are actually about 14 different species of clouds and 9 varieties. Really fascinating stuff, and they occur really at all levels of our atmosphere.
And I understand you have a couple of favorite kinds of clouds.
I do. I love, this is going to sound terrible given that what I just said about mass extinctions, but I love the polar stratospheric clouds called nacreous clouds or mother of pearl clouds, even though they're like actually a really bad sign of the ozone layer being destroyed. But they're beautiful. They only occur. They're very high altitude, 70,000 feet or higher, I believe, and they only occur at 60 degrees latitude or above. So basically, you know, the polar circles. But when you see them, it's like someone took iridescent finger paint and just smeared it across the sky. It doesn't look real. It looks like something from Star Wars or some other sci-fi movie.
And that was one of your favorites. What's another, maybe a happier one?
I'm such a downer. Sorry to everybody. But lenticular clouds, they are also very, very cool. And I'm sure you've all seen the photos of a single large mountain like Mount Hood or Mount Everest with this what looks like a stack of perfectly round flying saucers on top of it. Those are lenticular clouds. And they actually form when the air coming over the mountains kind of gets trapped, and they just stack up there, and they look seriously like a stack of plates, and they're just really neat, and apparently they are what's behind a lot of flying saucer UFO sightings.
Interesting. Okay, that's a cool one. Wow, we've got a few more and not much time to get to them. Let's look at personality. What amazed me about reading about what we understand about human personality is how little we for sure understand about human personality and what it is.
Yeah, and that's really, it's so hard to figure out what it is and also how to measure it. You know, there have been a lot of scientists in the 20th century who approached it as like, well, I'm going to develop a way to test and categorize personality. But it's really hard to do. And so, for example, right now, I think a group of tests called the Big Five or the Ocean tests are very popular, and they test, as you might imagine from the name, five traits. But that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of other ways of testing, everything from projective tests like the Rorschach inkblots to these very involved tests where you describe different people in your life and their relationships to each other. And by describing other people who are in your life, the person analyzing you is able to tell a great deal about you and your personality. So I think it's there's still work to be done in this field, but it's really fascinating how many different directions it's taken off in terms of theories about how to figure out who we are.
And let's check in on who ants are very briefly, Jeb. A piece about ants. This is the one. I'm going to key in on one fact here. There is a colony of ants that spreads like around a huge chunk of the Mediterranean, international, multi-country, and it's all these sub-ant colonies that seem to be part of one big super colony.
Yeah, there are these a couple species of ants. They're originally from Argentina, but they've spread all around the world, and they do form super colonies. And the largest one that's known is 2,500 miles long. And it starts, if you imagine a map of Europe, it starts in northwestern Spain and follows the Atlantic coast and then the Mediterranean all the way to northern Italy. And it's one super colony. It's got millions of queens, billions of workers. It's considered a super colony because if an ant, say, from northern Portugal, the super colony corner of northern Portugal, ran into one from Italy, they would actually not fight. And they would get along and, you know, be kind of kumbaya about it, if ants can ever be kumbaya. So it's kind of fascinating.
Well, I, for one, want to be the first to welcome our new ant overlords. Gemma, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us once a month to share some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science.